Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis that, in spite of the use of arms in Libya, non-violent struggle still may be the most effective way to topple dictators. The director of the Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research at Wesleyan University, Erica Chenoweth, joins us. She has an article at Foreign Policy, Think Again, Nonviolent Resistance, which compares the violent liberation of Libya that cost an untold number of lives with the ongoing nonviolent liberation of Syria that has cost considerably fewer lives. Then, now that Rick Perry is surging ahead of the pack of Republican presidential hopefuls, we'll get a profile of the Texas governor from Dave Mann, the executive editor of the Texas Observer, who has been following Perry for years. We'll try to find out whether this skillful politician is something more than a cynical opportunist who runs a crony capitalist patronage operation, and whether or not Rick Perry has a political ideology. Then finally, we'll speak with Josh Tickell and Rebecca Harrell Tickell, the filmmakers of Freedom, a new feature documentary that makes a powerful case that oil interests have cleverly used public relations and propaganda to undercut public support for biofuels. Oil companies claim to be in favor of reducing our dependence on foreign oil, but are they in fact making us more dependent and less secure while discrediting more viable, cheap, and less polluting homegrown alternative fuels? Joining us now is Erica Chenoweth, who is a professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. Previously, she was a fellow at the International Security Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her books include Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and the forthcoming Why Democracy Encourages Terrorism. She has an article on foreign policy called Think Again, Nonviolent Resistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erica Chenoweth.
Thank you.
And given that violence was used in removing Gaddafi, not that he's entirely out of the picture, how does the case apply to Libya when it seems so obvious that the case that you've made in your foreign policy article applies to Syria?
Yeah, so one of the things I want to make clear is that all of the claims I'm making are probabilistic, meaning that not only are they based on probabilities based on all of the analysis from 1900 to 2006 of previous cases, but they also are highly contingent on local conditions. The argument I'm making is that nonviolent resistance tends to be a superior strategic choice when used against brutal regimes for a host of reasons. But we also recognize in our book particularly that 25% of violent campaigns have also succeeded. So just because you use violence doesn't mean that you're going to fail. It just means that you're about half as likely to succeed as if you rely solely on nonviolent resistance. In fact, I think the Syrian case proves this point somewhat because despite the fact that Assad has been brutally repressing people and estimates are that over 2,000 people, civilians, have died in that conflict so far, the nonviolent movement persists, and you can see that there are widespread condemnations, even from other brutal dictators, against Assad's behavior. Whereas many of them showed more support for Gaddafi as soon as that rebellion turned violent.
But, Eric, one of the things apparently that's keeping Assad in power is the help he's getting from Iran, not just about $6 to $7 billion in credits, but also the Al-Quds force apparently is there, according to analysis from the Europeans. The Quds are there helping him, and you know they got practice cracking down on the Green Movement in Iran. So, would that suggest that you have, that the Iranians are in effect exporting the opposite argument to yours, which is the ability to break nonviolent resistant movements?
Yeah. So, I think that in our study we actually used the support of a regime by an outside regime as one of the variables that might explain whether a regime can sustain this type of movement. And what we found is that external support from an important ally is not that important in explaining whether a grassroots movement succeeds or fails. It can certainly complicate the case, and I think you're right that if Iran hadn't continued to support Syria, we would have seen Assad fall much more quickly. But I also want to make a very strong point that it doesn't necessarily preclude the success of the movement, because the movement will succeed by eroding the regime's power from within. And they do that all the time by basically expanding their membership and by removing the regime from its key sources of power, in this case, the security forces, economic elites, and civilian bureaucrats that are keeping that regime moving on a day-to-day basis. Those are the people whose non-cooperation will ultimately bring down the regime. And it's very difficult to convince them to stop cooperating with the regime when they feel violently threatened by armed insurgents.
And I've spoken in the past at length with Gene Sharp, and as you know, some of his works have been employed by Otpor in Serbia and by the Arab Spring revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, even though he himself does not claim to be in any way, he doesn't feel in any way he can take credit for any of this. So what credit would you give Gene Sharp?
Well, I think he is a little modest when he says he can't take any credit. On the other hand, I know that there are many people in Egypt and Tunisia who say that even though they saw Gene Sharp's materials circulating in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, that it was their revolution and that, you know, they could have done it without Gene Sharp, too. I think we need to empirically study that question. We need to talk to movement activists and find out exactly to what extent they were actively training and preparing using his materials. I can say that that particularly Egypt had a bit of a Gene Sharp flavor to it, insofar as the movement, those that were kind of prepared and organizing the movement were following the suggestions that he lays out in his book, Politics of Nonviolent Action. They were mixing their tactics. They were extremely well prepared for repression and had multiple plan Bs and plan Cs and plan Ds for how to deal with it when it happened. They weren't over-reliant on any particular tactics that made them very vulnerable to regime repression, and they well played the critical element of getting the army to not cooperate with the regime, and I think that was the key for them.
So just to go back to the current example of Libya, and clearly there does seem to be something universal about these revolutions in the Arab Spring, and that is the aspirations, particularly of the young. The word dignity comes up a lot, the idea that they feel that the elites have stolen their futures and they want to restore their own personal dignity. In the case of course, in Syria, the bravery on the part of the people who take to the streets every day facing tanks and artillery is something that I don't think we could we certainly, you know, over here, maybe if a few people have their heads cracked by police and maybe get pepper sprayed or tear gas, but this is a whole other level of nonviolence, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think that's right. And one thing that's very interesting is that you see the youth, especially in Egypt and Tunisia, starting to express discouragement about their role in the transition. But this is also a continuity from other previous nonviolent uprisings. Take Serbia as an example. The Otpor movement had a somewhat controversial role in the ouster of Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. A lot of people say that they've overstated the extent to which they affected that movement and so forth, but ultimately they did have an important role in that. But then they tried to form a political party and run for parliament, and they thought that because of the important role they played in the Serbian revolution, that they would be rewarded at the polls. And actually what happened is they got hardly any of the vote at all. And the feedback they got from the Serbian people was, we want you to throw out our dictators, but we don't want you to rule us. And so I think a lot of the youth feel discouraged when they recognize that that's the sentiment, yet it's also very predictable based on past.
But the one thing that's different about the Arab Spring revolutions, I guess, is the degree to which the dictators are prepared to be ruthless. And clearly Mubarak folded under international pressure, even though the Saudi king every day was calling up Obama and screaming at him, saying, let Mubarak shoot those kids in Tahrir Square. Assad, we've seen what he's done. the Saudis essentially trying to bribe their youth and give them money so that they won't be disaffected, which of course they are. But just to take the Libyan example of the day, what do you think would have happened had the protest stayed nonviolent at the very moment when NATO intervened, where the president intervened on the basis of what he thought would be a humanitarian catastrophe in Benghazi, where Gaddafi had already said that he would crush these people like insects?
Yeah, I think that I'd say two things about it. First of all, I think that there wouldn't necessarily have been more bloodshed than there was with the NATO intervention, the bombings, and the campaigns against Gaddafi's remaining army. I think that, you know, there may have been people that sort of put themselves in a position using nonviolent action to be repressed, but there are a host of nonviolent actions available to these campaigns that don't put them at high risk for repression, like strikes, boycotts, stay-at-homes, things like this that are actually fairly disruptive, particularly to the economy, but don't put people in harm's way. That's not to say that Gaddafi wouldn't have tried to go house to house, pull people out of their homes and make them go back to work or terrorize them in horrible ways, which we know he was capable of doing. But that's just to say that people wouldn't necessarily have to have been in harm's way. We do have reports that casualty rates have been around 13,000, for instance, in this months-long conflict, whereas in Syria, which has gone on longer, only 2,000 people are dead under Assad's brutality. The second point I would make is that at least some reports by people like Juan Cole and also an op-ed writer in the New York Times today indicate that there was actually mass civil resistance going on in Tripoli before the rebels even got there. Apparently, hundreds of thousands of people hit the streets and, what Juan Cole says, essentially cast off the regime, which suggests that civil resistance may have actually had more of a part to play in the Libyan endgame than most analysts are recognizing at this moment.
One of the things, though, that you learn about these much-feared dictators when they finally are brought down is the kind of delusional and pathetic nature of them. I mean, the sort of, little Napoleonic martinets dressed up with all of their... I mean, I saw one of the Berbers sacking Gaddafi's palace wearing his military hat with all of the scrambled egg and gold chains and stuff. And, you know, Mubarak is now a pathetic figure. Is there any way that you can expose that the emperor has no clothes before the downfall?
Yeah, and I think that's a brilliant strategy, and movements should exploit that because... there are a lot of quirks about people. For instance, Imelda Marcos, you know, she was infamous for her shoes and how much she loved shoes and that she just accumulated all of this wealth and spent it on things. And Filipinos definitely mocked that during the uprising. With Ben Ali in Tunisia, there was similar mocking that was happening against his wife and family, who were the source of a lot of grievance because of their perceived corruption. And humor plays a huge role in many of these uprisings. For instance, the Polisario Front in Morocco's in Western Sahara is illegal. It's illegal to show the secessionist flag. So one of the things that these movements did was the nonviolent movement, that is, they actually gathered up a lot of stray cats in Morocco and tied these flags onto their tails and then set them loose in this public square. And the desired effect is exactly what they got, which was that all of the security forces were chasing these cats around the public square, making it look like they were trying to herd cats. And, people laughed. And that's exactly the effect that these movements want to have, which is to unify people behind a common set of knowledge that people share but don't usually say out loud because they're afraid of retaliation.
And how much do you think, Erica Chenoweth, that's operating in Syria? Because I know there's a popular anthem there, Bashar Leave, and I believe they've changed the tune a little bit now, saying something to the effect that, well, now that Gaddafi's gone, it's your turn next. How much did I've also seen some very effective rap songs from Syria. So give us a sense of how that's working.
Well, I think the primary function that this sort of activity has is that it helps people to overcome their fear. I've heard from a number of activists that something that really helps them when they're standing on the front lines and essentially facing down automatic gunfire from these leaders is that they sing, and they have comedy skits that they put on together just to lighten the atmosphere a little bit and make people less afraid and feel like they're more a part of a whole. And for some reason, that's helpful to people. And I think humor and music and rap and slogans like this serve a similar purpose. They're much more powerful than just words. They're serving a psychological or a cognitive function. Doug McAdam calls it cognitive liberation, just the idea where suddenly you realize that you can do things you couldn't do before because you're in a group. And so I think that the slogans really help with that.
And do you see any likelihood, that we'll be seeing any of these activities on our streets? Not that we have dictatorships by comparison, but recently I'm sure you saw what happened in the streets of London. Most of that was criminality, organized, by the way, by social media. But there were elements of political protest in terms of class protest. What's your sense of protest in this country, much of which, I guess, comes from the left, except for the Tea Party. But they've been so successful politically. Do you see anything on the horizon?
Well, I actually see things happening all the time. I'm in the Bay Area at the moment, and so there are BART protests going on because of a shooting of a man and the Civic Center BART over the 4th of July weekend by BART police. And, of course, the big scuttlebutt about that is that the BART police have shut down cell phone service so that people couldn't coordinate more protests and disrupt the service. And so, they're accusing BART police of behaving just like the Arab dictators with shutting down social media. I don't know about that, but basically I see protests happening in the United States nonstop. The main difference here is that the grievances that people usually have, whether they're on the left, the right, or in the middle, are not as widely shared, typically, as the grievances that people in the Middle East and North Africa have at the moment. Even if people are critical of President Obama, for instance, most people are not willing to give up a week's worth of pay or even their jobs or their livelihoods to go out in the streets until he's gone. And one of the things that we know about these nonviolent movements particularly is that they require great numbers of people participating in order to succeed.
Well, that's not to say, though, that occasionally the protests can be cleverly tailored. For example, I spoke yesterday with Bill McKibben, who was arrested over the weekend for protesting in front of the White House, and he's an environmentalist who's organized a serial of people showing up there, and it's a 2-week long protest,
right?
That as they arrest them, more will come, and that's meant to focus the president on the choice that he has to make whether or not to allow the tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to cross the United States through a pipeline to refineries in Texas. I would say that that's a pretty clever strategy. It seems to, at least it got my attention,
Yes, that's right. And most of these movements, if they're well-planned, well-coordinated, unified behind a common message that has real resonance with people, and it's really hard to argue with their legitimate grievances, and they can find a way to sort of undermine the interests of the incumbent to maintain the status quo, they can affect change, no doubt about it. And I think that in this country, that's usually the type of change we're going to be looking at. It isn't this sort of regime change where you're casting off an entire government system or a leader, but it's policy changes. And we've actually seen a lot of different effective social movements in this country related to that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Erica Chenoweth. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Erica Chenoweth, who's a professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. Previously, she was a fellow at the International Security Program at the Belfast Center at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her books include Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of a Nonviolent Conflict, and the forthcoming Why Democracy Encourages Terrorism. She has an article at Foreign Policy called Think Again, Nonviolent Resistance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dave Mann, who is the executive editor of the nonprofit progressive news organization, The Texas Observer, where he writes the Contrarian column. He has been following Governor Rick Perry for years. Dave Mann currently has an article in the New Republic titled, Whatever Rick Perry's Record Is, It's Not Conservative. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dave Mann.
Thank you.
And when you say his record is not conservative, what do you mean by that?
Well, I'd say that his record, while kind of generally conservative, if you look at the overall frame, I mean, he talks a lot about low taxes and low regulation and things that you would generally think of as conservative. When you begin to look at the details of his major policy proposals in his decade as governor of Texas, you see some proposals that aren't what most people would consider quote-unquote conservative. And the main examples of that being a major toll road project that Perry proposed, in which we were going to sign a contract with a foreign company to build toll roads all over the state and use the government's eminent domain power to condemn farmland for that toll road. That project eventually failed, basically because of resistance from rural Republicans. There's a famous incident in 2007 when Perry tried to require that all young girls in Texas receive a vaccine for HPV. That also was shot down because of resistance from conservative Republicans. And he also passed a business tax in this state back in 2006, which basically increased taxes on business. And I think from most perspectives, you'd say that hasn't been a successful policy because it hasn't brought in very much money for the state and has resulted in some budget deficits, basically, in Texas. So you look at those major proposals, and I think a lot of people wouldn't consider those to be very conservative. And in fact, a lot of Republicans and libertarians in Texas don't like Perry for those very reasons because of those proposals.
But it looks like the broad American public, at least the Republican primary voter, is starting to like him. The race, as you know, has always been crowded, and more enter it because nobody's making any headway and breaking out of the pack. And then suddenly he shows up and he's got a double-digit lead over most of them in the recent polls.
Yeah, I think Perry is very good not only on the campaign trail and very good at the so-called retail politics and very good in front of small crowds. He's incredibly charismatic. He's very good on that level, but he's also very good at appealing to different audiences within the Republican Party. He certainly is a religious guy. He has painted himself as a religious candidate. He knows how to appeal to Christian evangelicals and to the religious right of the Republican Party. But he also has been very close to big business, especially in Texas. And he certainly knows how to get along with the business wing of the party. So, you know, I think a lot of people see Perry as kind of this hybrid candidate. You can kind of bring together different wings of the party, both the business end, the kind of big business guys, and the country club Republicans, and also appeal to the more grassroots, Tea Party activists, and Christian evangelicals, a coalition that worked wonders for Bush in his runs for office. So in terms of him being a front runner, I think Perry has achieved that because he appeals so well to the different wings of the Republican Party.
My understanding, I've spoken to Wayne Slater and Jim Moore and some other reporters down in Texas who've also covered him, and I get the impression that, you know, he's somewhat a cynical opportunist, that he never met a wealthy donor that he didn't he didn't want to carry his water for. And is this guy just out for himself and will take care of his cronies? That's the impression that I'm beginning to get.
Yeah, I wouldn't describe that as inaccurate. I mean, he's built a record in Texas that quite a few people have described as crony capitalism, and I would argue with that. I'd say it's a pretty accurate description. In fact, you could say that his biggest accomplishment in Texas has been building a very impressive network of political patronage and cronyism all across state government. He's appointed everyone, you know, everyone who can be appointed in Texas state government, he's appointed them. And the word in this state is that if you want a government appointment from Rick Perry, you have to give a campaign contribution. In fact, of the hundreds of people he's appointed, when a public interest group here in Austin ran the numbers, the total came out to $17 million in campaign contributions to Perry's campaign from people he's appointed. So, you know, I think a lot of politicians get contributions from their appointees, but $17 million is a lot. And, you know, I think we've seen Perry taking that to a new level. He's has an economic development fund that consists of taxpayer money that he doles out to companies for job creation grants. And he's bragged about that quite a bit and said, well, these grants that he's giving are partly responsible for Texas's job growth, the so-called Texas miracle. And these grants have created jobs. But as we've reported and other people have pointed out, these job grants are going to very politically connected companies and companies and CEOs who are also contributing to the governor's campaign. In 2003, he created a housing regulatory agency that can only be described as incredibly friendly to home builders. And home builders in this state have been some of Perry's most generous contributors, the most notable one being Bob Perry, a Houston home builder and one of the biggest Republican donors in the country. He's not related to Perry. They share a last name, but they certainly share a lot of business and political connections. You know, the list goes on and on. I mean, I think what we've seen here is Perry has shifted his ideology quite a bit. He'll kind of say what he thinks he needs to say to win an election, but when you look at his record, what he consistently does over and over is pass policies that are very friendly to big business and very friendly to people who have contributed to his campaign.
So, Dave Mann, given that it wasn't so long ago that Rick Perry supported Al Gore, and now he's running on the Republican ticket to become president of the United States, and he's obviously got a lot of support from Texas because they were running ads in Iowa before he even entered the race, a group of supporters. Is this to say, though, that he doesn't have any ideology, that he's quite simply a cynical opportunist? You know, what indications do you have that he actually has a belief system?
Well, if his belief system is often very hard to discern. I mean, I would characterize him as very generally conservative. I mean, you point out he was a Democrat, and he helped chair Al Gore's presidential campaign in Texas in 1988. But even when he was a Democrat, he was a conservative Democrat, which wasn't unusual in Texas in those days. A lot of those conservative Democrats later switched to become Republicans, as Perry did. So I would say his overall ideology is generally conservative. You know, he's always kind of supported limits on lawsuit abuse and tax cuts and light regulation, things that were generally good for business. You know, if he has an ideology, I would say that's it. But again, within that framework, the details have shifted quite a bit. You know, he's, like I said, I pointed out earlier, he once raised taxes on business in this state back in 2006. Again, he proposed this toll road project, which used eminent domain authority, only a few years later to propose an emergency bill limiting government's eminent domain authority. You know, he's shifted positions on immigration. He was quite a moderate on immigration for years until just this past legislative session when it looked like he was going to run for president. All of a sudden, he became much more of a kind of hardcore anti-immigration guy. So I think with Rick Perry, I wouldn't say he has no ideology, but he's one of these politicians whose ideology changes to match what is politically expedient at the moment. And for my money, he's one of the worst at that that I've ever seen. I mean, George Bush wasn't exactly a policy guy either, but I do think that Bush cared pretty deeply about education policy. I mean, I think that was one area that Bush was willing to work with Democrats on. He wanted to make a difference. You know, we don't even see that from Rick Perry. I mean, his education policy is kind of shifting continuously. One year he's promoting pay increases for teachers and pre-kindergarten, and 2 years later he's cutting funding for education and laying off teachers and cutting pre-K. So it's, you know, I think Perry's, in terms of his shifting policy details, unlike any politician I've seen in Texas. So while generally conservative, when you get down to the details, this is a guy who will say what he needs to say to win elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Dave Mann, executive editor of the Texas Observer, where he writes the Contrarian column. He's also been following Governor Rick Perry for years. Now, I understand, just apropos what you just said, Dave, that he is very clever in the sense that one of the ways he beat Kay Bailey Hutchison, who was very popular in the state, was embracing the Tea Party. He saw the potential of the Tea Party being a force in the Republican Party. And you recall at one of the rallies, he sort of mentioned the notion of seceding. He's been saying some inflammatory stuff since he entered the race. You know, it's upset a lot of people, but it's his poll numbers are going up. So he seems to know how to send the right signals to the people that are, I guess in this case, to the people that matter in the Republican primary voter.
Yeah, Rick Perry is very astute politically. That may be his greatest advantage, his greatest skill. He's got terrific political instincts. He's a very good campaigner. He's very charismatic. But more than that, he's attuned to what the next big thing is going to be. And you mentioned the rally here in Austin in 2009 where Perry made the now infamous secession remark. And at the time, everybody here in Texas and I think people across the country kind of thought he was crazy. I mean, that just sounded like a huge mistake and just the kind of thing you don't say. And in fact, when you look back on it, it was turned out to be to Perry's political advantage because he was getting out front of that Tea Party movement and kind of establishing his Tea Party bona fides, where if you look at his record, there are plenty of things that Tea Party activists would be quite unhappy about, and some of them are. But because of that remark and because of his realizing how powerful the Tea Party would be, he got out in front of that. He structured a campaign for re-election against Kay Bailey Hutchison that was basically based on anti-Washington rhetoric. You know, when in the years before that, when Bush was president, I never really heard Perry rail against Washington. You know, this was a phenomenon of the last 2 years, and it was very potent against Kay Bailey Hutchison. You have to remember, Kay Bailey was the most popular politician in Texas when she got in the race against Perry in 2010, and she had a huge money advantage. She was 20 points ahead in the polls. And, you know, within 6 months, Perry had completely turned that around, and he ended up blowing her out in the 2010 Republican primary for governor. And that was basically because he ran such a good campaign and found a winning message, found this anti-Washington message that was very successful against Kay Bailey Hutchison as a politician, and also was successful because it tapped into people's frustrations at the time, you know, particularly Republican primary voters. So, yeah, I mean, this is a theme with Perry. He's kind of out there saying things that are controversial, that seem like gaffes, seem like mistakes, but he's not going to back down. He's not going to apologize for these remarks, and in fact, he's probably going to double down on them. You know, we're going to see more of these kinds of things. And, you know, I think his campaign and the candidate himself, Perry, believes that these are the kinds of things that Republican primary voters want to hear. And, you know, he's saying them because I think he believes they're to his political benefit. And I wouldn't bet against him.
So, Dave Mann, are you suggesting that that remarks that he made about Ben Bernanke saying it would be treasonous for him to print more money, and if he came down to Texas, things could get pretty ugly for him, that wasn't off the cuff? That was a planned remark. It certainly got a lot of attention.
I don't know for certain that was a planned remark. It might have been an off the cuff remark, but it wouldn't surprise me if that was part of their strategy. That you're gonna get out there and criticize printing more money. You're gonna criticize the Federal Reserve. you know, I think they feel like that could be a winning message with some Republican primary voters, with some Tea Party folks, and they're going to hit on that. And maybe the campaign feels like Perry might have gone a little bit too far with the treasonous remark. I don't personally know, but like I said, they're not going to back down. They're going to keep arguing their point. So was it a gaffe, or was it off the cuff, or was it planned? I don't know for certain, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if they had intentionally said, we're going to intentionally planned to go after the Fed pretty hard at some point and make some pretty out there comments. Like I said, I feel like they've got a plan and they're going to come out with comments they feel like are going to benefit them politically, and they're not going to back down and they're not going to apologize. They're going to, Rick Perry's nothing if not an aggressive politician. And so even if it was a bit of a gaffe, it's within the framework of what he wants to do. It's, if he wants to criticize the Fed, he's going to go all the way. And if he maybe stepped an inch over the line, he's not going to apologize for it.
Sure. Well, but he's also stealing the thunder from the two that won the Iowa straw poll. They came, both came in almost in first place, and that's Michelle Bachmann and Ron Paul. That's literally Ron Paul rhetoric. So I can see how it's benefited him and maybe explain his bump in the polls where he's way ahead of the whole pack now. What about his relationship with George W. Bush, in particular Karl Rove? Karl Rove ran the campaign, the K. Bailey Hutchinson campaign. So Karl Rove doesn't like losing. I take it there's no love lost there between Perry and the Bushes and Karl Rove.
No, the Bush camp and the Perry camp have disliked each other for a very long time. People kind of trace it back to the early 90s. There was a major split in 1998 when Perry, who was running for lieutenant governor at the time, wanted to run a very negative campaign. And Karl Rove and the Bush people didn't want that because George W. Bush was running for re-election as Texas governor at the top of the ticket. And he wanted a very positive message. He wanted a big turnout to show that Bush could attract all kinds of voters and help his presidential ambitions. And that was kind of the political split. But I think the split between the Bush and Perry people is very much about cultural identities. I mean, Bush, you know, is very much this kind of blue blood Republican, country club Republican, you know, Andover, Yale. You know, we know where the Bushies are coming from. And Perry is not that at all. I mean, Perry is a West Texas guy. He grew up on a ranch. They did not have money growing up. He went to Texas A&M, flew planes in the Air Force, has always been much more kind of ground up, much more in tune with the grassroots of the Republican Party, and has always kind of viewed himself as a bit of a political outsider, which is odd given how long he's been governor here. But, you know, compared to Bush and the kind of powers that be in the National Party and Washington, D.C., I think Perry thinks of himself as an outsider, and that's why some of his anti-Washington rhetoric is so effective, because that's what he's tapping into. Not necessarily anger at the federal government, I would say, but more kind of his own outsider feelings.
Well, Dave,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I thank you for joining us and filling us in on the new Republican frontrunner, who may go all the way. I would not discount that possibility.
No, I wouldn't either. He's a terrific politician, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see him get the nomination.
Again, I've been speaking with Dave Mann, who's executive editor of the nonprofit progressive news organization, the Texas Observer, where he writes the Contrarian column. He has been following Governor Rick Perry for years. Dave Mann currently has an article in the New Republic titled, "Whatever Rick Perry's Record Is, It's Not Conservative." We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the filmmakers of a new film called Freedom.
All my exes live in Texas, and Texas is a place I dearly love to be. But all my exes live in Texas, and that's why
we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The
sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Joining us now is Josh Tickell and Rebecca Harrell Tickell, who are the director and producer of the new film Freedom. Their film Fuel won the 2008 Sundance Film Festival Audience Award for Best Documentary. Josh Tickell has published two books on sustainable energy, From the Fryer to the Fuel Tank, The Complete Guide to Using Vegetable Oil as an Alternative Fuel, and Biodiesel America. Rebecca Harrell Tickell is the author of Hot, Rich and Green, The Secret Formula Women Are Using to Get Rich and Save the Planet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Tickell and Rebecca Harrell Tickell.
Thank you
for having us.
And the film that you've made is really quite extraordinary. And I was stunned to learn that, I guess to some extent I've been a victim of the misinformation campaign in terms of biofuels, particularly about ethanol. It's been a very effective campaign to discredit ethanol, particularly amongst the environmental movement. And I was astounded to learn that there's a complete historical analogy here that Henry Ford, who grew up on a farm, knew about making ethanol, and apparently it was quite common in those days, used for all kinds of things on the farm, not to mention alcohol to consume. And when he created the Model T, he also created a huge ethanol refinery that it became a massive part of the fuel for Model Ts. And what killed off that fuel was Prohibition, which I had no idea that Prohibition was in large part funded by Rockefeller, who was quite a religious person. But really, his real motivation in apparently the Prohibition language of the bill that prohibited alcohol was specifically to shut down alcohol as a fuel for cars. And it's not difficult to assume that the pious Rockefeller was actually more concerned not about American sobriety, but about getting rid of a rival fuel to petroleum. Am I correct?
That's correct. And really, Standard Oil's sort of co-opting of the women's temperance movement was the first example of an oil company co-opting a religious or social organization as a front for their agenda. And that's the modus operandi that we see the oil industry using continuously for the past 150 years up till today, where the threat of a fuel that is grown on American soil, that's controlled by American people, that's cleaner for the air, and that's cheaper would certainly inspire the same sort of behavior from the oil companies, which it in fact did and has inspired recently. And instead of co-opting the religious movement, they just co-opted the environmental movement.
And Rebecca, the campaign has been quite thorough because it's become a kind of truism, at least an accepted truth, that the high price of food has everything to do with the high price of corn, because corn ethanol is forcing up the price of food. And your film, Freedom, makes it incredibly clear, one, that the corn used for ethanol is completely inedible, and two, I was going to talk to Senator Bernie Sanders about this in early next week. I just talked to him today. He's been looking into what's been gaming the price of food and gasoline on the commodities market. And now they have evidence, which is a lot of people were suspicious for a long time, that the market was being gamed. And indeed, Morgan Stanley and the other Goldman Sachs have been really, inflating that market, and to the extent that they're the world's biggest holders of oil there for a while. So it seems to me that this is a huge story. Now, why is it, do you think that the press are picking up on it? Is it because they were had?
Absolutely. I mean, we've all kind of been had. You know, it's a complicated thing to really understand, but to make it simple, you know, making fuel from a byproduct of corn has nothing to do with the amount of food that's available to people. What people don't realize is it's only a fraction of the cost of our food that is actually going to the actual cost of the food itself. So the majority of what we're paying when we buy something that's corn-based is not for the corn, it's for the petroleum that is used to ship the corn. It's for the packaging. It's for the shipping. You know, there's even oil that's used in the process of making the food. So they spray it with pesticides. They grow it in fertilizer that's petroleum-based. So when the cost of oil goes up, so does the cost of food around the world. But it was a really brilliant idea to say, oh, well, the reason why the cost of food went up was because they're taking so much of it and they're making fuel from it. But that's just not the case, and we proved that in the Freedom film.
So what do you think is going on here, Josh, in terms of, I thought that there was a political constituency for ethanol, you know, not the least of which Iowa is the first state, and all the politicians are up there making all kinds of promises. So how did they manage to eviscerate the industry so much with this propaganda campaign, and what's keeping it going?
What's keeping it going is essentially the $1 billion a day that we spend importing oil into the U.S., and the $1 billion a day approximately, in addition to that, that we spend subsidizing oil. So in essence, we are keeping it going. We're funding the campaign. And what most people don't realize is this is almost half the GDP of the United States. So we're embroiled in these conversations about debt ceilings and rising stock commodities prices. All of it is essentially tied to our own stupidity. You know, we are essentially bludgeoning ourselves with a blunt object on a daily basis and wondering repeatedly in political conversations and TV conversations. I mean, just listen to the media. Listen to the conversations. You know, people go, why can't we get off of oil? Well, it's because you're feeding the beast. And the only way to get off of oil is to stop feeding the beast. And this is like such a simple, painfully simple conversation. But for some reason, we are involved in a self-perpetuating cycle. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. We go to the gas station. We pay for oil. The oil industry creates propaganda, which makes us believe that any substitution for oil is actually worse than oil. So we keep paying for oil, so the economy collapses. And so we're left wondering why the economy is collapsing. And it really boils down to, fundamentally, we have become a society that is so divorced from the resources that we use on a daily basis that we'll believe anything. We will literally believe anything. And so when the American people are told, well, the price of non-food corn that isn't fed to humans, 30% of which is returned back into protein to feed to animals, that's made into ethanol, is pushing up your food prices, when they're told that, they believe it. And they believe it lock, stock, and barrel. So it's A, no wonder that we can't get off of the oil fix. We are feeding the machine that is feeding us lies. And B, it's no wonder that the media and the government and the public are in lockstep supporting an industry that's destroying the bottom line of America. And the most threatening thing to oil, the most threatening thing, is that we would have, let's say, 1 to 5%, a tiny margin, of the American consumers take the cars that they drive off of oil. They know, the oil industry knows you're not going to do it with electric cars, because the changeover to electric cars is 10 to 25 to 35 years, depending on where we get the lithium. So the reality is the oil industry is in control. And unless we do something radical, like support an unpopular idea, like taking crops that farmers grow that are not used for food and turning them into fuel, and taking a radical minority, not even a majority, just a radical minority of people, and using that fuel in their cars instead of oil, there will be no change. You can expect that the next generation of your Prius will be fueled on coal and oil and nuclear. And you will continue to wonder why nothing changes. And the answer is, you're putting it in your gas tank.
But that's not to say that people aren't taking a stand. I just spoke yesterday with Bill McKibben, who spent last weekend in jail. He's protesting in front of the White House because there's a plan to build a pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta to refineries in Texas that would cross the United States carrying this thick, viscous tar sand, which already has created a nightmarish Mordor-like scene up there in Alberta, because the amounts of water it takes to separate the sand from the tar creates huge ponds of polluted water, and then they have to heat the oil with natural gas, and then they're going to pump it all the way down, and it's the highest concentration of carbon there is. And the former chief scientist for NASA, Jim Hansen, says if that stuff gets on the market, it's game over for the environment. And then in your film, you go through the whole BP a nightmare scenario, and you grew up in that part of the world down there on the Louisiana coast, Josh. So it's not as if there's not, you know, extenuating evidence out there. But so what explains how gullible people are when here we have a homegrown alternative to gasoline that's perfectly viable, that works well, that can be made cheaper, and it's less polluting, and it started to take off, and the oil companies, through their political connections and through their sway in the media, managed to pull off a bait and switch. I mean, nobody likes them. So I'm astounded by this disconnect.
Well, it's amazing the lengths that they will go to create the feeling of security for American consumers. Look at any of the major publications that are writing or that wrote about the fuel versus food debate. They all cited two studies. Both of those studies were done by essentially paid advertisers. One was by a lawyer who has deep connections to the coal industry. The other one was by a bug doctor, an entomologist, who won't publish the sources of funding for his papers. He's a tenured professor at Cornell. So the oil industry is very insidious in the way that it works, to the point where there's a whole program of how to install fuel pumps at gas stations. Fuel pumps are actually designed to look like ATM machines. So there's a psychology that goes behind it. There's a pseudoscience, a paid-for science that goes behind it. And then there's the oil industry is so smart that they know what the environmental movement is going to do. Like the whole protesting about the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a shocking thing that we even have to protest this. It's a shocking thing we'd even allow this thing to be built. But the reality is, California is the largest consumer of oil in the United States. We already get oil from the tar sands in Canada. It's already happening. So, Bill McKibben is a huge hero of mine. He's a brilliant person. But as much as they are protesting in D.C. against the Keystone XL pipeline, people are still filling up their cars in California today. So, this is why the oil companies have traditionally won, because the environmental movement hasn't actually taken a stand for something. They know. They'll keep standing against. They'll stand against the tar sands. They'll stand against MTBE. But just as easily as they'll stand against those things, they will not stand up for anything. And the oil companies know you only have one choice at the gas station. As long as you only have one choice, you have no freedom. And that's the game. That's how it's played. It's played psychologically. It's played in the magazines, in the front, huge full-page color, full bleed ad that Texaco and Exxon take out that say, we're doing great things for the environment. It's played out in D.C. where politicians and environmentalists alike will say, no, 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 we don't need this oil, it's bad. And then they get in their cars and they drive home. Mm-hmm. So it's a complete hypocrisy for anyone to say, this is bad, or this is wrong, or we're not going to do it, or we're actually standing up for oil. As long as you're driving on oil, you're doing the one thing they need you to do to win. And that's the psychology. They know that unless you change your behavior and you actually change your money, that, plenty of people who are listening to this program right now are driving their cars. Those cars are filled with gasoline. We have almost as many cars in the U.S. as people. So the great thing about this conversation, the great thing about what KPFK is doing, letting us talk about this film, and the great thing about the Freedom Film, is we're breaking it up. It's an uncomfortable subject because no one wants to take responsibility. Mm. But what if we could turn it around and say, not only can you take responsibility, you can drive cheaper, you can save $200 to $500 a year off your gas bill. You can support American farmers who today are growing a lot of corn. They're growing corn because we in the United States demand a lot of beef and we demand a lot of corn syrup. Not that those are good things, but that's, again, what we're voting for with our dollars. Those same farmers are willing to switch to hemp. They're willing to switch to other crops. And all of that would be inside of Americans empowering themselves, getting back to our roots, and getting clear on where we actually get our stuff. Because we were clear that our stuff, our oil, is coming from the Gulf of Mexico and the Alberta tar sands, and people really got the impact of their decision, and they were standing at the pump and they said, do I want it from the tar sands? Do I want it from the toxified Gulf of Mexico, where BP lied to the American people and destroyed up to 4 million people's livelihoods forever? Or do I want it from the Midwest, where I can actually meet the person who's making this, have a conversation, and learn that the propaganda that I've been fed isn't true, and that, in fact, I'm putting money back into our economy? I guarantee you, 85 to 95% of people would not choose oil made from ExxonMobil, Chevron, and all of those companies. They would choose fuel made from the United States.
Yeah.
And that choice is actually available.
Sure. Well, let me ask Rebecca Harrell-Tickell about a couple of things in the film, just in the last minute or two here, that again show that there's real alternatives out there in the real world. And 60 Minutes just did a big piece on how Brazil is the new economy, the new emerging power, and we all know that China and Brazil have tremendous growth rates. One of the successes of Brazil is entirely to do with the fact that they don't have to buy oil, they don't have to run a current accounts deficit, and that they supply most of their automobiles with homemade ethanol made from sugar, which at the pump is half the price of gas. So there it is. Every time you pull up, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah. I mean, what people forget is that we're spending over $1 billion a day importing foreign oil. And we could completely turn that around. We could be like Brazil. We could be an energy exporting country. What would that do for our economy? We wouldn't have to have these conversations in D.C. about increasing our debt ceiling. It would be a totally different conversation. And I think Josh is making an excellent point. You know, when you go to a gas pump, if you had a choice between the Midwest or even the Mideast, you know, like when you look at your food, for instance, it tells you where it comes from, what it consists of, but our fuel doesn't do that. And that's how we continue going on asleep. We go to the pump, we fill up our car with gasoline, we continue without any freedom, forgetting that we could completely transform this country right now today with a waste stream that we already have in existence, perfectly in harmony with the environment. And that's really the way to be sustainable, is to mimic Mother Nature. And that is available to us right now. But in order to get that, we have to stop pointing fingers and actually do something about it. And that's where we failed. You know, environmentalists, we are fickle. If we hear one tiny thing about something, we give up on it and we search for the next silver bullet solution. And we don't have to do that anymore.
Well, I thank you for your film, both of you, because it really does. And as I said at the beginning, I feel that I've been had, because they very successfully planted this idea that there was something wrong with ethanol, there was more energy used to create it, which was a lie, and that it was crowding out food supply and driving up the price of food, which was another big lie. And you've traced the source of this lie. And my program more often than not deals with national security issues, and I know some of the people you interviewed, former CIA director and national security advisor Bud McFarland and Wes Clark, I've interviewed them all. And they, of course, make this strong national security argument that this is insane. You know, all this money's going out the door to people who want to kill us at any rate, and we could be creating jobs at home with this money. I mean,
there is no comparison. If you compare ethanol to petroleum, there is no comparison. And for anybody that's interested in finding out more about these myths that we're talking about, on the freedomfilm.com website under Learn, you can find out all about these myths and all of the things that debunk them.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Rebecca Harrell-Tickell and Josh Tickell, producer and director of the new documentary, Freedom.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Bye-bye. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.